This is Rating Descending,
where we watch IMDb's Worst 250 so you don't have to.
My name is Abigail Ward.
And I'm Michelle St. Clair.
And tonight we watched Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2. A group of tourists arrives in Burkittsville, Maryland after seeing the Blair Witch Project to explore the mythology and phenomenon, only to come face to face with their own neuroses and possibly the witch herself. Let's watch.
Hey.
W-Y-D question mark.
What?
W-Y-D question mark.
Wide?
What are you doing?
Oh. We're recording, Abby. You know what I'm doing. We're looking at each other.
Smiley face.
Smiley face.
B-R-B.
You're laughing out loud. Oh, you're going to be... Where'd you go? Where did you go? You know, no, my keyboard is made of like shell and... It's like a keyboard on like an alien ship in like a 90s movie. You know, like aliens, I feel like especially in the 90s, although they still are, but especially in the 90s, were all made of goo. They're very sticky and sloppy, you know? It would be like, they'd be like a shell-based alien and they would like have like a carapace, but then everything they had would like have that sheen that you just know is either sticky or slimy. Or both. Those aren't mutually exclusive, you know? I feel like aliens now are a lot more sterile. Oh, you're back.
Back.
Oh, cool.
Smiley face.
Did you see my big wall of text? Is that okay? That's...
Lol. LMAO.
Unmatch.
Dude, I remember years ago, I was...
When aliens were sticky and sloppy?
Yeah, which coincided with when I was like on dating apps. I was like purposefully antagonistic towards men that I would match with. And I just remember one guy matched with me and he was like, I'd like to hold your hand sometime. And I said, bold of you to assume I have hands.
I remember that one. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah. I was not a pleasant person to match with.
No, you just so desperately didn't want to do it or engage with
it. It's just more like, it's just 95% of them were just infuriating or boring.
You really did find the one man you're attracted to.
I know.
You would date people and then be miserable the whole time.
Yeah.
You would hate them and describe how you didn't like them until I then agreed with you that you didn't like them, at which point you would get very defensive of how
but
you liked
no,
them.
No, he's great.
He's great. I love all the stuff about
he
him.
He likes Tame Impala. And he describes himself as a feminist, but that remains to be seen.
Hey, look, we got Jonah Hill over here. Topical.
Yeah, that whole Jonah Hill controversy.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Will it still count as topical when this releases? I don't know. Topics have such a short fucking shelf span? Lifespan on the shelf. Shelf life.
Shelf span.
Shelf span.
I'm thinking a good 2 meters of shelf.
is this our worst opening yet?
No, it's going pretty well, I would
say. Okay, cool.
You know the thing with Jonah Hill, like, I think
he's
boundaries...
He's a sticky, sloppy alien.
Yes, and his boundaries are crazy.
Yeah.
But there's also a little part of me that feels bad. I don't know why. Almost like what he's saying is strange and controlling.
Strange.
But I also feel like it's crazy that we can just show texts, like private texts of like, this is what I want in our relationship. These are my boundaries.
Yes.
Blah, blah, blah. And like, if you're annoyed at your partner, or if you're being shitty or snarky, because people are just people. And then it's kind of blown up all over the world. And it's kind of scary. And what I'm saying, Michelle, is that you should watch the way you talk to Brooke, all right? Because Whoa. If you guys ever break up.
She's going to share screenshots of my texts.
And you'll be like, love you, baby.
Well, it'll mostly be like, hey, babe, you want to hear more about Final Fantasy 16? Babe, you haven't responded yet. Do you want to hear more?
W-I-D.
Do you want to hear more?
W-I-D.
And then she'll text, I'm at the shops. Do you need anything? I'm like, did you see my previous texts? Did you see them?
And she's going to post it and be like, look at what I had to put up with for years.
And everyone will be like, fair.
That's crazy.
I get it.
Yeah. And you're like, my boundaries are that you have to respond to my texts. About Final Fantasy VI.
Which is, just like Jonah Hill, what a boundary legitimately is, for sure. Me going, you have to respond to my text about Final Fantasy specifically. That's my boundary.
That's your boundary. Yeah. That's my boundary. kisses every day. That's my boundary. A little kiss on the cheek.
Kisses every day.
A little kiss a little is my boundary.
A little kiss. Little kiss. Little one kiss for boundaries.
Me, little kiss. Every single time I bring Claude like a tea or a coffee, I'm like, that'll be one kiss. And I'm like, he has to kiss me for it.
Yeah. What happens if needy. What happens if he doesn't?
I do actually. I really put up a fuss if I don't. If he doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a legitimate, like a baby fuss where you're like, or like a real fuss where you're like, Claude, what the fuck? Claude?
Kind of a mixture of both.
Come back.
Kind of a mixture of both. And like, I kind of stomp off a little bit and it's joking, but also I feel it. I feel it.
Right. But so you're like, instead of going, you're like, harumph.
Yes. Mm.
You're meant to give me a little kiss.
I'm usually like, that's fucked up. And I kind of stomp out and I wait for him to come back in. And then I'm like, you didn't give me a kiss before. And I don't let it drop until I get one.
Wow.
And then I'm happy
cool.
again.
That's fun. That's cool.
A marriage is just the trading of little kisses.
Mm.
We constantly barter. We're like at a little kiss market.
I'd hope so.
And we're haggling with little kisses.
For me, I live in the fucking free state of kisses. You know, the communist republic of kisses. All right, kisses
they have, like, Matthew McConaughey.
Kisses are freely given. They're not part of the bartering system at all.
Whereas for me and Claude, we use them against each other, 100%. We use them as leverage.
Now that one had Matthew McConaughey for sure.
Yeah.
Leverage. 2004, it was McConaughey and Kate Hudson.
And he's trying to find Confederate gold in the Sahara Desert.
All right, all right, all right.
All right, all right, all right.
Now listen, we're just trying to get some kisses.
I donate to his organization Just Keep Living every month, you know? He's an just inspiring man.
If anyone hasn't, they should go listen to Jen Kirkman's special. Yes. Was it called Just Keep Living?
Yeah, it was called JKL. No, it was called Just Keep Living, yeah.
Her tattoo is JKL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I should get that tattoo.
It's a good special.
It's a great special. Her story about the Italian tour guide that she's meant to go on a ghost tour and it's just her. And so he's like, oh, I feel so sorry for you. And he just tells her this horrible story. He tells her these like love stories under the bridge. And then they go, I shouldn't summarize this whole joke that she tells.
Now, this is good radio. You summarizing someone else's stand-up
and
story?
And not doing it as well.
But without the jokes and punchlines?
Giving up halfway through?
Because you know what I love about stand-up is the meat of the stories, not the jokes.
Yeah. I like to give people like the skin of it, but there's no meat beneath, you know?
Reading a Wikipedia summary of... of a stand-up special.
Really, that could have gone two ways. Like, I should have either A, not done it, or B, done it, but actually followed it through, and I didn't either. I got halfway through, and I lost my steam, and I went, it's not going to be good.
Well, that's not going to be. What is this podcast, if not that?
And I mean, speaking of not good.
Hey. Now, that's a pivot.
This week, we watched Book of Shadows, semicolon, Blair Witch 2.
Mm.
Weird title. It's very unusual for the new title of the sequel to come after the actual franchise name and then the two.
Yeah, it is odd for to lead with the subtitle.
It's really strange, and no wonder it's led to a lot of confusion, but we have to very specifically state it is Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2. And can I ask you straight off the bat?
Yeah.
Where was the Book of Shadows?
I don't know. I was going to ask because I haven't seen the original Blair Witch. I often do my due diligence and watch the original ones. Yeah. However, I've said many times before, I make an exception for that for horror movies, both because of the franchise lengths, cough, cough, Halloween, and B, because I'm a scared little girl.
You're a baby.
I'm a baby.
You're a little baby.
And I'll get spookied out, because every time I'm like, have you seen Blair Witch Project to someone? They're like, oh my God, it's so fucking scary. I'm like, I don't want to see it.
Well, here's the thing. So I actually did watch the first one for this one.
Was there a book with shadows in it? It sounds like a hard book to read, let's be honest.
There was no book of shadows in the first Blair Witch, nor was there one.
Are you kidding me? I open this book, it's full of shadows? Why? Am I doing Rodney Dangerfield?
Come on.
Oh my God, I'm fucking 60. What is this?
You are, deep down. No, but in the first one, I actually did... So when I was a kid, I watched Blair Witch Project, and I remember being scared by it, but I was such a kid. It was so long ago, I can't really...
Such a kid.
I can't really remember what it was like.
Mm.
And so I rewatched it today.
Oh!
And I rewatched it with Claude, because Claude really likes it. And it is... The first one is actually really good.
Isn't it the most profitable indie movie of all time, still?
It is, and actually I'm pretty sure it's up there with, I'm just trying to think of the other indie movie that it's being compared to that came out around the same time.
Around the same time. I was going to say like Paranormal Activity.
It's completely different in terms of genre. Oh. It's like a rom-com.
My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
That was it.
Yes, I know, because that I think the most it is also that like one of the most profitable
indie movies. And it came out like a year later.
Because it was also made for like, what, like 2 million or 5 million?
Blair Witch made that record and then... like, yeah, Big Fat Greek Wedding broke it the next year.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you remembered that. Because at first I was like, if you just said that as a joke, that's remarkable.
I was rereading about My Big Fat Greek Wedding just the other day.
It's a great film. It's a good time.
It's because they did a poster for the third one recently.
I
think they're going to make a third one. And it's like, you know that thing where like, these are clearly real photos of people, but when you airbrush to a certain point, it kind of looks like a drawing. And I'm like, you should have just paid someone to draw these people if you're going to make them look non-human. How did you uncanny valley a human being?
At least, look, there is no shortage of Greek weddings, I will say. Like, you'd hardly be like, oh, another one?
Yeah,
that's just life, baby.
I mean, what I hope in my heart of hearts is this is not her third Big Fat Greek Wedding.
What's wrong with that? Finding love again and again.
It maybe just kind of undermines the romance of the first one.
Maybe she's been widowed twice.
Well, that's also sad.
Yeah.
I don't hope that for her.
But the sadness shouldn't undermine the romance.
Okay, you know? But I said I hope it's not. And then the two reasons I gave are things that I don't want to happen.
It's like you've got this weird thing against, divorcees.
People are allowed to get divorced. I hope their marriage is good.
Mm.
And that their partners don't die.
Just something that's like toxic here. Listeners, if you think Michelle's somehow being toxic, email us at ratingdescending@gmail.com.
Yeah.
It really makes a difference.
I did nothing to earn this. Last week you bullied me about like Kelly Preston died. I'm like, I didn't say a single fucking bad word about Kelly Preston the whole episode.
Michelle, you yourself have said that you understand that the reason people wind you up is because you react.
I'm so easy to bully. I'm so easy to wind up.
I don't bully you. I challenge you. That's the label I would slap on it.
I feel like instinctively if I was a character in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, people would say I'm Charlie Kelly. However, I think at the end of the day, I'm a D makes sense. I was gonna say like a non-shitty Mac, because he gets wound up pretty easily.
D. Yeah, she gets wound up really easily and she gets bullied. You're like a giant bird.
Yeah, I'm D.
You're
Dennis.
We gotta get back to this. I am Dennis. I hate that.
No, we got to get back to onto it, because now we're ruining your reputation.
it was like ruined 3 episodes into this podcast, to be fair. True. This film, so yeah, we rewatched it today. The initial film, it had really good critic reviews.
Yeah.
It was made in 1999. It was like the best-selling like indie film ever. The budget of the initial film was like under $1 million. I think at the most it was like $750 million.
Yeah.
When they made it.
It's like minuscule, wasn't it?
It was minuscule. Well, when they made it, like, the production cost barely anything. The production was, like, almost... it was, like, under at least 250 mil, maybe less. Maybe it was under 50 mil in the production.
50,000?
50,000.
Cool. It's cool.
Thank you. 50,000. And then the post-production, like, I don't understand how, but it completely, like, ballooned the budget. And it meant that it ended up costing somewhere between 500 to 750 million. Oh, 750,000.
You know what it would have been?
Yeah.
Because also, this has happened to Australian movies colleagues of mine and stuff. It's sound. Like, part of it is color and, like, recoloring it and
sound.
Stuff. But the majority of it is sound, because when production is that cheap, the biggest thing is, like, everyone's mics suck.
Yeah.
You tend to need to re-record everyone, redo, like, all the sound and doing them to, like, proper levels.
I think it was the coloring, because I actually really liked the atmosphere and the color work that they did on the initial film. And some of the shots were really beautiful, despite it being really great. And they also made sure that all of the, and I'm sure this doesn't cost that much, but they had to, like, make sure that all of the footage looked older and grainier than it was. And I think that apparently like the layers and what they put on it was quite complicated. But either way, yeah, it ballooned in post. So it came out at most, it would have been $750,000. So, you know, well under $1 million. What do you think the initial film grossed?
50 million?
$250 million.
Oh my God.
An insane, insane return.
Absolutely.
An absolute success.
Incredible.
It is a dream. And I read a lot about the initial film because I didn't hate it at all.
Hmm.
It was actually really good for what it was. And it that, as Claude kept reminding me, it was like the first of these found footage films to really do this, what we used to. But you and I have been burned by watching so many of them, yeah. Which means that you can kind of see in retrospect how much they take from Blair Witch Project. So you can't help but scrutinize Blair Witch Project too, because it just does the classic thing of the hero or heroine basically like finally meets the spooky force and is killed and it's over.
Yeah.
And you're like, ugh.
It's the Hendrix problem. There was a period, I think it's kind of phased out because enough time has passed, but there was a period where, and I remember when I started learning how to play guitar, this happening, where like a lot of beginner guitarists and stuff would not respect Jimi Hendrix, an incredibly influential guitarist for his incredibly talented and innovative style,
yeah.
By going, well, everyone plays like that.
No, they don't.
But no, but like, yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people play like that because Jimi Hendrix played like that.
Yeah.
You know, no one played like that until that point.
Yeah, exactly. Was the whole thing, and that's the thing. Yeah, it's so easy to watch this and be like, oh, I'm having like horrible flashbacks to like the Ghost Dimension, you know, like
yeah.
To Paranormal Activity Ghost Dimension. But it itself, really good. And I know people say it's quite scary, but I would actually say to you, like, I don't think you would find it that scary.
Okay, cool.
It's not about gore or violence. It is this slow, creepy buildup of like strange things happening. But I think at this point, it's the kind of film that would leave you a bit flat. You're just like, oh, there's a strange mound of stones that are left outside the tent. There's creepy runes on the wall. There's sticks hanging that weren't there before. There's a guy screaming in the darkness. And there's creepy stories about this woods. It's more like the atmosphere of being stuck in these evil, dark woods.
Yeah.
But nothing, like, spoiler, there's no real, like, violence or gore at all. You would be fine with it.
Yeah, because you're right that the violence and gore really gets me sometimes. And you know the other thing that gets me in some horror things and sometimes in other TV shows? When it's just kind of sad.
Yeah.
We've talked about that in some of the horror movies. Like, sometimes the way that characters are killed, it's, like, not, like, titillating, and I'm like, that's just really sad. That's just someone dying.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Well, I'm just going to get into the key details now, because I do want to talk a bit about the original film before we talk about this one, if that's okay. Just because the original film was so fascinating to read about. So just some information on the original film before I get into the current film that we're doing.
Okay. It's a rating descending double sending
double penetration. We're going to DP it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Let's fucking penetrate Blair Witch.
Yeah. So the first one.
I didn't like that in the end.
The original Blair Witch was made in 1999. It was directed and edited by Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez. And these were two guys.
The guy that co-founded Facebook? That's right. I watched The Social Network. I had that one fucking locked and loaded. I think about that movie all the time.
It's a good movie.
It's fucking Andrew Garfield, baby.
It's Aaron Sorkin, baby.
No, I mean he's Eduardo Safran. He's the one who made Blair Witch Project. Yep, it's Andrew Garfield. Yes. Is he in it?
Yeah, he's in it. And this came out in 1999. It was, as we said, not made on much of a budget, absolute phenomenon, absolute success. The production of the first film is fascinating because I didn't realize how, and this is why I wanted to kind of set this up, is that when you watch the first one, and then after I watched the first one, I went back to Blair Witch Project 2 and I like rewatched a bit of it again.
Mm-hmm.
It's so tonally different. It is so bizarre.
The second one?
Yes.
Yeah, I could do nothing but imagine how tonally different
it
is.
You almost get whiplash from it. You're like, oh my God. You're like, when the second one starts with that Marilyn Manson rock song over the aerial shot, when you come off the first one, which you realize in retrospect, like, the first one is so graciously created.
It's kind of focused from what
really
I understand.
It's really focused. It gets to the nitty gritty. I think the characters are all like, there's a lot of tension, and it makes you realize how mature the first one was in comparison to this.
Yeah.
But the first one, the whole thing is that, you know, that there's the talks of like the Blair Witch in the forest, and they go out to investigate and they get lost, and they're lost out there for days until they start realize that they're being hunted, and one of their members gets lost and they find like a bundle of sticks with like his like shirt tied around it, and when she opens it, there's like all this blood in it and like a bit of flesh. It's really gross. And then they end up going to this dilapidated house, which is the house in this film, Blair Witch 2.
Yeah.
And she, like, it basically ends with them getting attacked, and, like, that's the end, right?
Okay.
So not much happens, but the atmosphere is pretty good.
Yeah.
That's the first one. What I didn't realize is that with the first one, I think the reason as well, the reason that it did so well and why people were probably so fascinated by it is that not only was the marketing campaign sensational, where they listed all the actors as presumed dead, so everyone, and they did that on IMDb.
Oh, cool.
So everyone really thought it, it became a sensation because everyone thought it really happened.
Yeah.
The young woman who played the main character in the Blair Witch Project, her mother got condolence letters saying, like, I'm so sorry about what happened to your daughter, because they really thought it wasn't a document. Like, it was a documentary.
I hope the mother knew that she was definitely alive, because... Because otherwise, like, that's a really cool thing to do intentionally. Because you know what I think about all the time?
What?
Have you heard the story about Cannibal Holocaust?
No.
So that's a movie, I'm pretty sure, from the 70s, maybe the late 60s.
I think I actually came across it in researching this. Because it found footage? Like, is it equivalent?
No, but the bit that's equivalent that might have been a reference, because it was made by, I'm pretty sure, an Italian film director. Yeah. I think it might be an Italian movie, but it had, like, American actors and stuff.
Yeah.
It's notorious for being really, really violent, right? I mean, it's called Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's get two hardcore words and stitch them together.
The violence in it was said to be, like, so visceral and stuff that it then became a rumor that was, like, then held as, like, trivia in, like, film circles, that it was actually a snuff film and that those were, like, real actors and they had actually taken them out and killed them and stuff, and they were like, no one's heard of the actors. And, like, years later, the director was like, That kind of ruined me. You know, like, these actors were alive, but everyone thought I went out and killed a bunch of people.
And that's so interesting, because the girl in the initial Blair Witch, first of all, when she rocked up on set in the woods, the first thing she said is this a snuff film? She asked the director. She was like, just be straight with me. Is this a snuff film?
I love that if it was, he'd be like, yeah.
Yeah, you got me.
Yeah, you got me. You got me. I was going to kill you.
Sue me.
Free to go. You're free to go.
You passed the test.
You did it.
But she also on set, like, she, what was I going to say? She thought it was a snuff film. Oh, yeah. And the lead, her name was Heather Donahue. And in the first play, which her name is Heather, you know, they all kept their real names. Josh was played by Joshua and Mike was played by Michael.
Yes.
Heather Donahue went on to say she ended up changing her name
in
real life to, I think her name is, like, Ray Hance now, I think. Like,
Ray Hance now? Oh,
Ray Hance. Right. I think it's like R-E-I.
Oh, okay.
And then H-A-I-N-C-E, I think, out of, like, from the top of my head. But let me just check. I actually have to know. It's not that interesting, but I don't want to get it wrong. Yeah, Ray Hance, H-A-N-C-E. She changed her name because of the correlation with her character.
Right.
Which is so funny because the character got her name from herself. But she said, like, that film kind of ruined my life. Like,
yeah,
that no one could separate me from the film. I couldn't get employment because of the film. She had to completely take, like, she left the acting industry, and now she sells cannabis. She's like,
fun.
I think she made a book about growing cannabis called, like, Grow Girls.
Fuck yeah, man. Yeah. That's but, girl dinner.
Yeah, girl dinner. I'm on TikTok. But she...
At Rating Descending.
It's funny that you say that, because in a way that Blair Witch was such a sensation and people thought it was so real that it ended up ruining the leading lady's life, essentially. Mm. And that the whole craze around everyone thinking it was real is obviously what's inspired the sequel. Because it was such a craze that people were, like, going to the town and they really wanted to try and find the Blair Witch because they thought it existed.
Crazy.
But also, it was about just the fact that the second film was clearly inspired by the production company trying to stress this wasn't real, now we're just taking the piss out of it.
Right.
Because they really had to drive home that wasn't a documentary. That was just a film.
Yeah.
Because the sequel just came out 1 year after the first one. There's no time. They just absolutely, like, steamrolled this into production because they were like, we have to explain that this was just a joke. Yeah, so that's...
Just being goo when you make Blair Witch Project because you're just being goofy.
And look, I'm not going to linger on it for too much longer because this is about the sequel.
Yeah, yeah.
But the first Blair Witch... Just the IMDb trivia section is a gold mine.
Wow.
Because what they did is that they filmed in the forest. The whole shoot took 8 days.
Wow.
They used a lot of people just off the street to get interviews where they would make up stories about what was in the woods. And then the kids, they dropped them in. And this is how production worked for the first film.
Mm.
They dropped the kids in, gave them, like, walkie-talkies and, like, ways to navigate and they gave them the film equipment, but they were like, even though there's a director, the director's not doing the footage. He's not holding the camera. It really is the three people that are actually doing the camera work. And so they're in the camp. They have their backpacks. They have all their gear. They have the walkie-talkies if they need help. But they are told which direction to walk in. And they walk in and they shoot. And then they camp that night. And then they get instructions. They wake up and there's been a drop from the crew that are following them but from far away.
Mm.
And the drop has food and tells them where to go next for that day. And like, what will happen?
I don't know why, but that has scared me more than any of the information you've said thus far, more than this movie did.
Well, get this.
That scared me.
Something I forgot to mention as well is that these actors that signed on to Blair Witch 1 had to sign a contract. Like, in their contract, they had to sign a section that said that they were okay to be emotionally manipulated and tricked. Like, they had to be okay. Oh, so it's like
a reality TV contract.
Basically, they were basically like, we're going to play mind games with you, and you have to be okay with it.
Okay.
And so they did a lot of things to scare them, and they wanted really natural responses. So at one point on the filming, like, there's a big moment in the film where they realize that they've been stuck, and they spent a whole day walking just to get back to the same point.
Mm.
And the crew did that to them on purpose, and the reactions are really the three people's reactions of, like, how are we back here?
Yeah.
Like, this doesn't make... I can't believe this. And they start, like, crying. And it's really horrible. Like, they are getting, like, these tricks played on them. And the production started dropping less and less food. So they were hungrier and hungrier. And it made them more irritable. The three actors, they weren't just fighting for the film. They were fighting in real life. And it's this odd thing where they knew they were in a film and that the Blair Witch thing was made up. But they didn't, the lines between reality and fiction really started blurring for them a lot because they were being manipulated. And in the end, like, one of the boys, Josh, ends up being taken. They didn't know that was going to happen.
Oh my God.
And so Josh is taken by the crew. He was woken up in the middle of the night and they're like, you have to come.
Yeah.
And so they wake up and they're like, where is Josh?
Oh my God.
And they can't find Josh again. And then Josh is planted in later in the film screaming from far away. Again, they didn't know that was going to happen.
Oh my God.
The leading lady said that the end of filming, she didn't know what was going to happen. And so she found it incredibly scary and traumatizing because they really manufactured it to be that the guy she's with at the end ends up getting possessed and she didn't know what was going to happen and she's like screaming and crying.
Oh my God.
And then they basically, someone on the crew makes her drop the camera and that's the end of the film. But in real life, she was forced to like drop it because she thought she was getting seized by something. Yeah. It's really like they really tried to make it as realistic as possible. So that's the fascination with Blair Witch is how dedicated they were to getting natural performances out of them.
Oh my God. Yeah.
It's amazing.
More than anything, what that makes me really hope, maybe it happened, it was 99, you know, is it makes me really believe in contracts in which the crew share in the profits, you know?
Yes.
Because I'm like, going through that is I would say, like, you're choosing, there is an ethics to it, but I'm like, if they get a share of that $250 million, otherwise, like, to do that for, like, an actor's wage of, like, 8 days where they get, like, $2,000, that's a lot. That's a lot to go through when other people just get to like stay on set and have coffee.
Yes, exactly right. Like you know? These people are just like camping out in the woods, having a good time and be like, all right, I'll go do the drop now. See you in 10 minutes. And there's these three actors like shivering. And apparently at one point they like lost all of their items. They got lost three times and had to radio for help.
Oh my God.
Apparently the director's like freaked out because the kids like they dropped them off and they were like, go that way. And the three of them went the exact wrong way.
Oh my God.
And everyone on the crew was like, this is going to be a disaster. Like they got lost immediately.
We just killed three actors.
All right, get the next three out.
We were trying to make again. We were trying to make a fake snuff film. I think we made a real one, Gabe.
Oh, shit. Everyone get out of here.
So Squam!
That's the first one, okay? So that's a bit of backstory.
Wait, that wasn't this one? That wasn't Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2?
Where was the Book of Shadows, dude?
I was going to ask, like 20 minutes ago in this episode, was there a Book of Shadows in Blair Witch 1?
No.
Even in the lore of the Blair Witch? Okay.
No.
Right. Okay.
Unless I'm misunderstanding something, and please, like, I feel like I've done a lot of research, and maybe truly there was, like, a reference that I've completely missed, maybe or, like, someone says something in the first film.
Maybe it's just a Wiccan thing.
Maybe.
And that's why we don't know it, because it's not our belief system.
But think of that film. Think of that first experience where it's so realistic and people are so entranced by it. Like, Roger Ebert gave it 4 out of 4 stars.
Yeah.
Like, it really captivated audiences. The marketing was amazing. The production was really intricate.
Yeah.
Really incredible filmmaking for what they did. Like, very revolutionary, very cool. Think of that.
Yeah.
And now let's go to the film that we're doing this week. Let's cut.
One of the goofiest goddamn movies I've seen.
It was actually a really fun film.
I don't think it was
stupid.
I think it was too boring to be a fun film.
You reckon? But, yeah. Oh, my mind's warped. I just don't know what I think anymore, to be honest. Yes, Michelle, you're right.
I think it's a lot better than, you know, we had the string of found footage movies. I think this is better than every single one of those.
It is, because it's not found footage.
I still think it has its place on the worst 250 of all time list.
Yeah. I think I was just glad it wasn't, like, really sad and slow. Like, to be honest, something that stuck with me is Wounds, because I hated it so much.
You really hated
it. I hated it so much. It makes me miserable thinking about it. And 11-11-11.
I did enjoy Armie Hammer having a really bad time.
Him being miserable.
Yeah, I loved that.
But then I had to watch him, like, interact with Dakota Johnson, and that made me sad.
Yeah, that's true.
I was like, oh my God, she's not safe.
Get her out of there.
It's a workplace hazard having Armie Hammer around.
Is that a bite mark? Oh, it's just a rash.
Oh, it's just a wound. It's just cockroaches infesting her. That's so hot. Anyway, Blair Witch 2 is so tonally different. Blair Witch 2 was directed and co-written not by the two guys that did Blair Witch 1. It was directed and co-written by Joe Berlinger. It was directed and co-written by Joe Berlinger, and I forgot to write the other person who wrote it, unfortunately. It was a $15 million budget.
Whoa! You're fucking kidding me. This cost $15 million? There's no fucking way. What did they spend it on? Are you fucking kidding me? This cost $15 million?
You're so insane.
That's fucking crazy. $15 million isn't even a huge budget. And you know what? I think it's $14 million too much for this movie. $15 million for, like, the five worst actors I've ever seen to hang out in, like, a loose warehouse?
We had the lead from Burn Notice in it, all right?
They're just out in the fucking woods for most of the movie. $15 million?
Yeah.
Was five of that on the helicopter shot?
On the aerial shot with the Marilyn Manson
stuff? That's fucking crazy.
How much do you think it made?
Five.
No.
Did it make a lot?
It made okay. It made a
50?
47.7 million.
Okay.
Very specific as a figure.
That's like, but obviously, that's not gangbusters, but that's
it's
a return.
Not like the first one, but it is a return. And the reason it had a return is that people were still fucking psyched about Blair Witch 1. And so they were like, Blair Witch 2, a year later, fuck yeah.
Hell yeah, now they're going to find a Book of Shadows.
The annoying thing is, the production company clearly wanted to capitalize on how popular the first one was. So we're like, let's get a second one out. And annoyingly, it worked. It made a fairly good return, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, that's the promise of art, of film as industry, right? Because film as industry is not required, but an uncomfortable reality just by proxy of the fact that film is one of the artistic mediums that requires the most upfront capital, and because in part it requires so many people. Like games, you can even make yourself, even though there's a huge requirement. But movies, you're going to have multiple people and stuff. And I feel like the way that we used to get around that was people go and make their artistic fucking project, Blair Witch, and then we just all accept that the production company is allowed to capitalize on that and then make another $30 million by making Blair Witch 2,
and
everybody wins.
And as we find out, they're also allowed to completely stick their finger into the new project and say, I want it this way and not that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll find this out.
That still sucks, but I guess, who cares?
I don't know. I actually feel really bad for the director. Okay. I'll tell you why later.
Okay.
Here's the overview for Blair Witch 2, so we can get stuck into it.
Please.
In 1999, tourists and fans of the Blair Witch Project descend on the small town of Burkittsville, Maryland, where the film was set. By the way, like, the first one was set there. It is a real town in Maryland. And even now, to this day, it's still known as, like, the Blair Witch Town, even though there's no real Blair Witch mythology.
Oh, yeah.
It's just for the film.
Wow.
Local resident Jeff orchestrates a group tour of locations featured in the film. Amongst the group are graduate student Stephen and his pregnant girlfriend Tristan, Erica, a Wiccan, and Kim, a goth. They can't.
But which, by the way, the movie is convinced that both of those things are equally oppressed minorities.
Yes. And they're both equally hot.
They're so
such babes.
Well, they're in love, right?
Well, they're definitely kissing a lot in the later. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, yeah, they probably are.
Yeah.
I feel like Kim, at least, is in love with Erica. The way that Kim talks to Erica is so much softer than the way she talks to anyone else.
I feel like it's one of those things where, like, because the industry is very like white and heteronormative and all of that shit and straight and all that shit, they don't realize that they're like making queer characters. I'm like, these women are both lesbians. Yeah,
if this film was made 20 years later, like, they would be out.
Yeah, you know? Eric is bi, and the goth, what was her name again?
Kim,
and Kim's a lesbian for sure.
Do you reckon?
Yeah,
I reckon Eric is a lesbian and Kim's bi. Two different worlds, man.
I get where you're coming. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Something to think about, Michelle.
Wow. That's interesting.
And also, I just want to say right now that my overview, you'll see that I wrap up a lot of stuff with one very small sentence because I couldn't even begin to try and go into it in the overview. So forgive me.
Okay.
They camp for a night in the ruins of Rustin Parr's house, which is the house in the finale of the first one, and they get fucked up. The group wake up in the morning to find the guy and the woman who are dating, they're like are researching into like the Blair Witch. They have all these documents. They're shredded. They wake up, everything's shredded everywhere.
I kept not being able to tell if they had been dating for months or whether they were married, but they were only dating.
I think they were just dating. And Jeff's cameras and equipment are destroyed. But they've managed to find his damaged tapes. And also I realized later the place they find his damaged tapes is where the Blair Witch tapes were initially dug up in 1995.
They say that.
Yeah. Tristan suffers a miscarriage very suddenly. They rush her to the hospital. And after she's discharged, the group retreat to Jeff's home so they can review the tapes they found.
His home is an abandoned warehouse.
It's an old factory.
You're like in the same woods.
Yeah, it's back in there's even like this voiceover that's like, are we back in the Black Hills? And they're like, yeah. And it's clearly like 80 yard because like we have to explain that they're back in the forest.
Because that whole bit confused me. Because also so this weird. Movie keeps jumping forwards in time and back. And I could not tell what was when. I had no fucking clue what was happening.
This is what I summarized. They all begin to hallucinate strange events around the house.
True.
I can't. Be bothered to go into all of it.
We get this every single horror movie where it's like they start to get killed in increasingly elaborate ways.
Yeah, like Kim drives a car and she crashes it. Turns out she didn't even crash it at all. And then there's like, they see a lot of shit, all right? There's like two people imagine having sex, but they're not having sex.
Erica literally vanishes into a pile of goo.
Yes, there's a lot of shit. I can't be bothered. They find the footage. Fuck. Eventually, they find out the footage from their lost night in the forest. And it shows the group descending into a demonic ritual where they kill another group of tourists in the forest. They confront Tristan, thinking she made them do it, and end up hanging her. They are then arrested and shown that they've been killing without realizing the whole time.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's a weird one.
It's an odd one.
Yeah. It's a tough one.
It's hard to have a movie effectively where the reveal in the third act is like, the things you saw the whole time weren't the things that were happening. It was actually a completely different set of events and different stuff happened. Because you're like, oh, so I didn't.
So none of. Okay, cool.
So that didn't happen. Something else happened.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing is that, like, they think they're having these innocent interactions. And then later in the film, they realize that, like, Kim thinks she was, like, confronting a woman that wouldn't sell beer to her. But it turns out she stabbed her to death.
Yeah.
And then, Jeff realizes that he killed Erica and puts her in a cupboard. And then they find her body
just
later. Kind
of, yeah, just, like, shoves her in a cupboard.
It's really funny when he shoves her in and he's, like, bare-assed and, like...
he's fully nude fully and sort nude. Of scampering around.
So when they go into these, like, fugue states, are they naked?
Which, by the way, even when they show that, they don't explain how she died.
Yeah.
It's literally... There's a news report at one point. I have written more quotes from this than any other movie.
Are they all from The Sheriff?
A lot of them are. But one of them, like the
disemboweled, news report, Jeffrey.
Disemboweled. Towards the end, he goes, I ain't no documentary filmmaker.
The performance from that man was remarkable. He was a real highlight.
Documentary filmmaker.
They've been disemboweled, Jeffrey. It's weird how he's like, I reckon you guys... He's like, basically like, I think you guys disemboweled these tourists. And he's like, don't leave the county. He's not like sending people over to arrest them. He's like, hey, don't leave.
Yeah.
Because we reckon you did
this. Like, we think you did it. Probably killed these five people. No, he doesn't even say don't leave. He says, don't leave the county.
Yeah.
They can go.
Yeah.
Just don't leave the county.
Look, go about your day. But we reckon you guys did murder these tourists. So just don't, you know, don't go too far afield.
He also says to Kim at one point, oh, you think your makeup and black clothes give you power?
Power.
It's one of my favorite lines in anything.
I have to say, like, the one note I did write down when I watched it the first time was just disemboweled Jeffery.
disemboweled Jeffery. But yeah, at the end, there's like the news report detailing it and they're talking about how Tristan and Erica were killed. And it was like, one was killed by hanging. The other cause of death is unknown. Like, even at the even end, they're like, Erica died somehow.
She was put in a closet.
Because the whole time they're going, how did Erica die? She's just here and in the closet. And then they're like, oh, but Tristan did it. Or Jeff did it. What did he do? Don't know.
But this is my confusion about it. The reason that they all turn on Tristan is that when they watch the tapes show that Tristan was orchestrating the demonic ritual.
Yeah.
That she was in this black robe, like, waving a stick around, which was very funny.
Everyone else was, like, nude and going feral.
They were having orgies.
Had a robe and a stick.
They were all, like, fucking and then, like, yeah, killing and slashing.
She, like, looks at the camera, too, and is, like, smiling a lot.
But it implies that she was the leader and she made them this way. However, when they all confront her and they watch the footage back of confronting her, because they hang her, and then when they're arrested, the sheriff shows them, like, this is the footage of you killing her, and she's just normal and she's not demonic or possessed, and she just says, like, what are you doing? I love you. Like, I didn't do this. And they hang her and you're like, whoa, they were like, they thought that she was possessed, but she wasn't. And I'm like, so does that mean that the tapes that they saw initially were wrong and made up as well? That the tape that they saw, she wasn't actually making them demonic in that ritual?
What you're doing in this moment is trying to figure out the way in which this movie works, and I think what you'll find is that it just doesn't.
That
just doesn't make sense. Which, by the way, his story, when his Steven's story, like, what we see happen initially, because Tristan puts the rope around her own neck and then is like, do it,
she's egging him on,
and he kind of like does it a little like by accident.
Yeah,
but he like fully launches her from quite a high up place in a concrete, like, even without the rope, she's dead for sure.
And also, he launches her with the rope around her neck and it snaps her neck. And that was the most gruesome bit of the film
for me.
The neck snapping. And then you have to see it again when he sees the tape of her actually begging for her life and not egging him on.
Yeah. It was sad. It was just sad.
It was horrible.
It was a little sad.
Yeah, it was really sad.
I guess in that case, it was spooky, but it was also like, what? It was spooky, but it was what?
Yeah, so this film, tonally and plot-wise, so different, right? It's like, it is not a found footage film. It has like it has one or two glimpses of the tapes that he's making, but that's it. There's a few tapes, but it's just a normal, like, you know, cinematic horror film.
It's a regular fucking movie.
Yes.
Also, for a movie so predicated on tapes, it annoys me that they don't understand how tapes work.
Mm.
There's a bit where I feel like they do, right? Because they're like, can you play it slower or make it bigger or something? Mm. And he, you know, can play it slower. Although that seems to add frames and that's not how it works. But he's like, I'll redigitize it as a higher resolution. I'm like, that is a thing he could potentially do with tape, right? Mm. I don't know what the original resolution he digitized it at. And the footage does look identical later, but we'll give him a pass, right? Mm. But then later, the fucking third act is predicated on them finding information from these tapes. Because at first they just see glimpses of nude woman and then they realize it's Erica and they're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And then Kim realizes later, backwards, Widdershins, oh, we gotta play the tapes backwards. And they play the tapes backwards and that's how they see all the extra information of what happened between 1:30 a.m. and then 6 a.m.
Yeah, their lost night.
They watched the tape multiple times. The way that a tape works, you can't go back to like the main menu and you have to rewind it to watch it again.
Yeah,
they rewound it many times.
That's
before
so
that.
That's so true.
We know that they did that.
What you're doing here is trying to explain the logic of this film.
I walked and there right is none. Fucking into that.
You know, a wise woman once told me. Just can't remember her name.
I walked right fucking into that.
Also, they followed the trend of like all of the main characters were named after the actors. So
yeah.
Jeffrey Patterson, who is the lead in Burn Notice, he's got a very distinct face.
That's why
I think
he was familiar.
He plays Jeffrey. Erica Gearson plays Erica. Stephen Ryan Parker plays Stephen. Kim Director.
Yes, that's right. I remember seeing that in the credits that her name was Kim Director.
Yeah, she plays Kim Diamond.
Kim Director is so funny.
The only real deviation is that Tristan is played by a woman called, and I think it's pronounced Tristine.
Tristine.
It's like T-I-N-E, not T-E-N at the end.
Okay.
Tristine. Tristine Schuyler. Yeah, so it's just they've continued that trend, but that's kind of as far as the
thematic similarity.
But I guess, like, it is. I've never watched a sequel to a horror film before where the sequel is saying the first film is a canon film and we're going to talk about that film and then we're going to talk about the fanatic fans around it.
Allegedly, that's also what Human Centipede 2 does.
Really?
I think thematically, though, this has less in common with that of the, like, we've canonized the original as a movie and we're engaging with it in that way. Really, I think this has more in common with Gremlins 2.
Which, I haven't seen Gremlins 2. Oh,
so have you seen the original Gremlins?
Wait, is Gremlins 2 set in a circus?
No. What? No.
Maybe I'm thinking of...
It's set in a skyscraper.
You fucking idiot.
Set in a skyscraper.
Is Gremlins 3 set in a circus?
There's no Gremlins 3.
Oh, dude,
there's
what no am I thinking of?
Fucking Gremlins 3.
Okay, what's the other franchise with little green things?
Little green things? Ghoulies. Oh, Ghoulies, I think, is a thing. Because we watched Critters. But none of those is in a circus.
Ghoulies 3.
Man, we gotta do. I gotta watch Critters 2 with you because I remember you didn't watch it. I watched it, and it was a good fucking time. Everyone should watch Critters 2.
Ghoulies is a comedy horror film franchise.
There we go.
But the second one is called Ghoulies 2. Sorry, the third one's called Ghoulies 3. Ghoulies Go to College. So I don't think it's.
Sure.
No, it is Ghoulies. I'm thinking of the second one's in a circus. Okay, we're moving on. I'm sorry.
Gremlins. You know, you get the original Gremlins. It is like dark comedy horror. You know, there's some very dark comedy in it, but it is still generally sort of horror-y. You know, the little Gremlins, the Mogwais, they turn bad at night.
Mm.
If they eat, you know, all of that shit. Great. And then the second Gremlins is kind of a parody of Gremlins.
Yeah.
And they introduce all these different Gremlins, you know, like because there's like some fucking serum or whatever. It's like the company that makes the Gremlins. They make Gremlins now. And there's like an electric Gremlin. There's a woman Gremlin that has big eyelashes and huge tits and stuff. And she like, hot. I think she fucks like a scientist.
The female Eminem of Gremlins.
It's Gremlins 2, The New Batch, which, again, should go into our canon of great subtitles. Yeah.
The New Batch.
The New Batch.
What about Ghoulies Go to College?
Ghoulies Go to College? Okay, yeah, yeah. But this should have been Blair Witch 2, The New Batch.
Really quickly, do you know what ghoulies look like?
No, I have no idea what ghoulies look like.
I'll just show you, because this is why I confuse them with gremlins. Like, this is why I need you to understand.
Blair Witch is not when I thought we would talk about the difference between gremlins, ghoulies, and critters.
This is a ghoulie. They're very small.
Oh!
They're small little green things.
Oh, I don't like that at all.
No.
That's like an ugly gremlin.
It's like a weird
and
evil
gremlins
little
are not
green,
pretty.
Like puppet, you know?
Yeah, that's like a man. It's like a...
It's like if Oscar the Grouch was, you know, hairless.
Yeah.
That's what I imagine he looks like under all that hair. Anyway.
Yeah.
How did we get onto?
Oh, because this is spiritually like Gremlins 2, in that it is somewhat parodic of the first movie.
Maybe we should add Ghoulies Go to College to our bonus episodes, because it doesn't even have a Wikipedia page.
Oh, I don't think we should then, because one of us is going to need to then talk about it.
That's true. No, I think I've seen glimpses of it, and I feel like there'll be a lot to talk about.
Okay.
It's really bizarre. But going back to why we're here, yeah. Blair Witch 2... I will say the reason that I did have a lot of fun with it was probably just because I really liked the Kim and Erica characters.
Yeah.
I was getting a lot of Charmed. I was getting a lot of The Craft.
I watched this with my darling girlfriend, Brooke, if not by her choice. but because Erica is Wiccan and talks about it a lot, I said two things that I'm going to repeat in this moment.
Okay.
One is that Wicca feels very 90s, and that's not, I think, because that was necessarily the peak of its popularity, but I think that's when it became popular enough to enter the mainstream as a modern movement that is, let's be honest, fundamentally neo-pagan, and that's more tied to the 70s than it's tied to any, like, the actual 1500s or any actual witchcraft. But that's when it entered the mainstream enough that people started talking about it, and I think now they're just bored of it.
No, it really was a trend. In the late 90s, you had so much about the idea of witchcraft. There was Sabrina
but like
the Teenage
modern
Witch.
Witchcraft.
Yeah, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, you had Charmed.
You had Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2.
You had Buffy. There was a lot of things exploring supernatural forces, and it was really trendy. And that also coincided
And Buffy with, knew the witches are gay.
I was actually listening to a podcast about this. The late 90s craze of witchcraft and wizardry... It really came at a time where people were also really afraid of it. Like, there were a lot of Christians hating on it.
It was like D&D satanic panic.
It was the literal like late 90s satanic panic, where there was all of these pop culture things that were focusing on how cool witchcraft could be.
Mm.
And then all of these like white Christians freaking out about it. And also at the same time, you had school shootings, and the people in America were comparing. They were like, the Columbine shooters like witchcraft, and they liked Marilyn Manson. There is a link in this film, but they like these things. So therefore, it is cursed. It is black. It is dark. And so the satanic panic of the 90s like really informed the culture, which was like radicals leaning into this.
I know moral panics operate on a level that like they tap into the fear part of your brain that then ends up like displacing the reasoning ability of your brain. And that's how they like catch on as like a collective moral panic. We see it happen many, many times. A modern one with the same fucking demographic is trans people. And every time it's like, can you settle down and use your fucking head for two seconds? This is the dumbest thing.
Yeah.
Just chill out.
What didn't help, and look, this is not a tangent we need to go down for a long time because it's dark and we have a lot of stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
But the whole thing with like Columbine as well is that when Columbine.
Oh my God. No,
it's a terrible preface. Hey, look, bad tangent.
But I don't know if this is the podcast for this.
Well, the Columbine thing, the whole school shooter debate really tied into a lot of the satanic panic where people were like, guys in trench coats listen to Marilyn Manson and they like films about like witchcraft and they like Buffy, so therefore they're going to kill my Christian child.
Yeah.
And then what fed into that is that there was these strange stories surrounding like, especially with like school shootings, where a lot of kids were targeted because they were Christian and stood up for their Christian beliefs, and therefore they were shot. And that just kind of
fed. It's not true. But.
Yeah, it's not true. It actually it's been quite disproven like over the years. And there's been even at the Virginia Tech shooting, there was a story of a girl being like, "I refuse to denounce Jesus," and they killed her. You know, she became a saint. Either way, all of that bled into each other. And I think the late 90s was such an interesting time. And this film really demonstrates all of that shit.
We wouldn't be doing our due diligence if, when we talk about Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2, if we didn't bring up Columbine.
In my copy for this week, it'll be like, Columbine, comma.
Don't.
Ghoulies, go to college. And Columbine, R.I.P.
Thoughts and prayers. Anyway, to get back to the original point, I liked Erica because the other of the two things I was going to say
how we started with
after
this.
Late 90s Wicca was because I think witchcraft is neat from like a story perspective. In a thing of, I'm like, as soon as I have to actually engage with it, I have to change a lot of my fundamental understanding of the world based on how it works. I can't suspend my disbelief in that way. But it's neat and it's kind of funky and cool. One of my favorite comics, Black Magic, is very like modern witchcraft sort of thing. Mm. It's really, really, really
Practical
great.
Practical Magic was another one.
That's one of my mom's favorite.
It's one of
movies.
My mom's favorite as well. And so
Witches
of Eastwick. Yeah. Yes. Also just witches. I mean, that was British. Oh,
yeah.
It wasn't American.
Witches too. Yeah. But, you know, and Erica.
wouldn't be a podcast episode of Rating Descending without a little burp.
Yeah. Erica really embodies that specific thing as well, even down to the red hair, which historically has been used a lot for druids in media for a lot of reasons tied to both like Celtic mythology and also the red hair being a long story thing for like this person is different without being non-white.
And the red hair was a very particular choice because it was a wig. And the actress just had short blonde hair underneath.
Wow. Well, she looks good with red hair. But she also is like there. Her whole thing is that she likes the Blair Witch because she was going to learn from her or something.
Yeah.
And she says she was an earth child like me. I thought was really funny. She also later, because they get these scars over their body that are and
they look like little rashes, but it turns out they're like those runes, that script that's everywhere.
And she says, "But Kim, they're growing." And
yeah,
I don't know why, but that one really stood. They're growing. But Kim, they're growing. This movie was, you know what, this movie was fun. This was silly.
It actually was really silly. And there was also moments where they were trying to be funny. They clearly didn't take it too seriously. I genuinely don't think they did.
I think they couldn't have. There's no way that Kim can deliver some of these lines and not be like, this is silly.
Well, this is the thing. I think that the production company really didn't want to take it too seriously. And I think the director took it seriously, but not in a like, this is an important piece of work. It's just I want to do really well with this.
Yeah.
And so the story of what happened with this this film is tragic. Like, do you want to, should we go into some trivia?
Sure. Can I quickly say another one of my favorite lines, please, which was when, you know, Tristan's whole, her running gag for the whole thing is that she keeps spouting gibberish. She's like the most possessed of them for a long time.
She's having the dreams and visions of the original Blair Witch.
And so she starts like saying gibberish about the original Blair Witch. Yeah. And Stephen just goes, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Which I think Jeff says that.
Jeff is talking to Stephen and Jeff turns and he's like, what are you talking about? And Stephen goes, you're not mad.
Either of them, it's perfect.
Look, I don't blame you for, you know, swapping the two male characters. They were very similar.
They were very similar.
Actually, Jeff was such a dick, though. There's a treat because he's, like, trying to work on the... I don't know what he's doing at that computer for so long where he's trying to, like transcode the tapes so they can watch it.
Mm.
But he's sitting there and he keeps demanding that the women get him coffee, which is he does. Weird. And then when they do, he doesn't even acknowledge that it's there. He's just like, coffee, and they're like, it's there.
Caffeine.
Yeah. Such a dickhead.
I will say another part of this will be my last thing and then we'll go to trivia. One of the other parts of that news report at the end, it literally begins with, as has happened many times in America, violent art has inspired more violence. And I'm like,
Satanic panic.
What a fucking stance to take in this movie. Satanic panic.
Let's talk about some trivia. Yeah. Let's get into it. So the director of this film was John Berlinger, and I think he really thought this through. I think he was really into, like, I think he watched a lot of horror films trying to get ready for this. Mm. He asked the actors to watch some horror films. He did some, I haven't included this in the trivia because there was actually so much about his process, but he was really excited for the characters to experiment in, like, the actors to experiment in their characters. He even made them swap roles occasionally just to see how they found it. And a lot of them ended up playing different roles than they had initially started as. So I think the girl who played Erica had gone in for Kim.
Mm.
And I'm pretty sure Jeff had auditioned for Steven.
Mm.
So there was a lot of swapping around because he really liked experimenting, like, how they felt in these little archetype roles. Like, archetype is a strong word for these.
Feels very fresh
flat.
Out of drama school, but
yes, it is. But he's trying. He's trying new things.
He's trying.
He wasn't absent, and he wasn't like, I don't give a shit about this project, which I respect. I actually think this was a man really trying. He notes that the different characters in this film and how they represent different archetypes in American culture and how they reacted to the Blair Witch Project included. Wow, that someone wrote the sentence really strangely.
Okay.
Sorry. John Berlinger notes the different characters in this film. They're meant to represent different archetypes in American culture and how they all reacted to the Blair Witch Project.
Mm.
Included are the Wiccans, who were upset with the way that the first film misrepresented them, the goth crowd, who were infatuated with the paranormal and outside-the-box nature of the first film, the intellectuals who wanted to debate the film's mythos, and the entrepreneurs who looked to make money off of the film's success. So that was his idea. He was like, these are the four types of people that I've noticed are really into the first film.
I can tell, because one thing I will say about John Berlinger, not subtle with themes.
No. And not subtle with archetypes.
No.
Because the intellectuals just have intellectual debates and then they end up kissing passionately because so in love.
I mean, look, one main criticism I have is that scene where they're at night, like, having these conversations about philosophy is, like, such student filmmaking.
Yeah, 100%.
You know. It's baby's first thought, you know. Oh, what if things weren't real?
And the sad thing, well, this was Joe Berlinger's. This was his debut directorial feature.
I haven't been less surprised by anything you've said this whole time. Yeah.
Apparently, the reason that he got this project is that he'd initially gone, so Artisan was the production house that, like, basically did the first film, and they really just stumbled into such an incredible, they stumbled into such a return. He had gone to Artisan to pitch an idea for his first feature, but they weren't interested in it. Instead, they sent him three scripts they were looking at for a possible sequel to the Blair Witch Project. So they had, like, three different sequels already going. He passed on the scripts, but they asked how he would handle a sequel himself. He pitched them his idea, and they bought it, giving him only 9 months to deliver the finished film, as the release date had already been set.
Oh, my God!
He said...
From him pitching it? Jesus!
He said, it's a miracle that that movie even got finished.
This is actually really good, then.
Really impressive.
I'm fucking turned around. Yeah. 9 months?
I have a lot of respect.
Full script, full movie. This movie should be so much worse.
And get this, like, again, I didn't include this in the trivia, But all of the actors said they had a wonderful time on set. The mood was really great. The atmosphere was fantastic. They were really encouraged to experiment and to get really into their roles. And I feel like you can actually...
the opposite of the first one.
Yes, you can really tell that like it was a good vibe on set. At least for me, I'm like, this actually doesn't have... No transphobia.
Yeah.
No sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
And hey, it was... I mean, it was 2000, but that counts as 90s. That's honorary 90s. No homophobia either.
No homophobia.
The 90s loved slipping it in there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like, they loved just, like, making women kiss, but they were like, but it's we're cool about it. We're free about it.
Yeah, I mean...
Because it's hot.
Yeah, I know it was meant to be like, oh, that's how, like, satan... I'm like, no, but these women would kiss.
Yes, exactly.
They're in love.
Yeah. There was a real trend in the late 90s where they were, like, kind of making women kiss to be a bit edgy. Like, did you ever watch Wild Thing?
Wild Things. Well, that's because that's acceptable queerness because you can ogle at it.
Exactly. Men can ogle at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a series of studio intrusions with this film. So like they kept sticking their finger in all the time.
I imagine if you make 200, if you're a production company at the tier where you are the ones buying Blair Witch and then you make a $250 million return, I imagine that completely destroys your ability to be chill about any project again.
100%. And they were so controlling about everything. For instance, the whole massacre at the end where you find out they killed the tourists.
Yeah.
That is meant to be just a reveal at the end, but they show you the shots of the massacre throughout the film immediately. And that was not something the director wanted to do, but the production company made him do it.
That's such a shame because it makes scenes more confusing than they need to be.
It does. It makes them so confusing. He also didn't want the backstory of Jeffrey being in an insane asylum because it makes him more villainous than he should have been.
Mm.
And he was like, Jeffrey's not a bad guy. He actually isn't.
That was a flashback?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was a flash forward to like his final fate.
He came out, and there's a bit where Kim says to him in passing, where she goes, you know how she's a bit psychic?
Yeah.
Kim is a bit psychic.
She's a bit, it's a runner that leads to nothing.
It's so weird, because she like looks at Tristan, and she's like, you're pregnant. And Tristan's like, how did you know? And she's like, I don't know.
You're pregnant, and he wants it, and you don't. It's so intense.
It's so intense. To be honest, that's what I'm like in conversation, though. I feel like I'm like, tell me all of your trauma. You seem like this kind of person. But she does that. And then there's a bit where she's walking past Jeffrey and she laughs at him and she's like, they let you out too early. And you can see he's like, how the fuck does she know that I was in an insane asylum? Anyway, I was like, wow, I picked up on something in this terrible film. They did one thing right. So that's his backstory.
So that's what it was. When they were feeding him the goo?
It's bizarre.
Okay.
The director didn't want to do it.
He was right. Strange. He was making a slightly better movie.
He was. And he also thought that in terms of the tone, he really wanted the tone to be more similar to the first film, but just not found footage. And then the company were like, no, you need to make it incredibly appealing. It can't be like a found footage film. We need people to know this is a movie. And they really drove that home the whole time. Here's an example.
Yeah. Again, I guess if you make $250 million and then people also go, did you really kill people? You'd be like, we didn't kill people.
We didn't. We promise.
Give us another $200 million.
The film was originally opened with Frank Sinatra's song Witchcraft
to give off
a lighter atmosphere before the plot unfolded. But Artisan Entertainment forced Joe Berlinger to instead include Marilyn Manson's Disposable Teens for the opening scene for a punk rock feel. And I find that so funny because I thought the choice of that song was so jarring and horrible.
It's too on the nose.
It was too much.
It's too silly.
Yeah, it was too much.
Sinatra, that would have been fun.
It would have been a great
vibe. That would have been fun. Oh my God. There was a Secret Urban Legends 2 that was being made and Artisan just destroyed it.
Also, another discussion by the studio that Joe Berlinger disagrees with was to have the ghost girl evaporate. Do you remember when Tristan's in her hospital bed and she sees that girl called something Treacle? She's a little girl that talks to her.
Yeah, we see the little girl a couple times, right?
Yes, and every time she disappears, she steps backwards while she's like shimmying and shuffling and she disappears. Every time she did it, I was like cackling. It was the silliest effect I've ever seen.
It's very silly.
He didn't want her to do that. The director wanted the girl to disappear through cuts between POV shots.
Classic.
He felt his method worked better as fake outs, and he thinks that the disappearing effect looked really bad.
Yeah.
Whoever decided on the person here wrote freaky backward dancing thing remains a mystery. And I just thought that is such a highlight of the film for me. She kind of spreads her arms out and like steps backwards while she's kind of like shaking and shimmying and she's disappearing. It's fantastic. And here's my last piece of trivia. So the town of Burkittsville is really fascinating. It's the town where it was shot. It's got a lot of history. There's a historic district. There was a couple of Civil War battles there. Most of the people in Burkittsville disapproved of the sequel because apparently like the whole town really got infested with fans. Yeah. They were like coming in. They were asking questions. They thought it was real. They were out in the woods. Apparently it ruined the whole hunting season in the area because there were so many fans in the woods. The wildlife didn't come out.
Oh no.
All the animals were saved from being shot. But I just love like what a profound effect it had.
Yeah.
Most of the people in Burkittsville disapproved of the sequel, and as Joe Berlinger says, chase them out of town. The documentary footage at the beginning of the film was pieced together from the small handful of residents who would actually participate, which is so unlike the first one where they managed to just get a bunch of people being like, yeah, I'll tell a weird story for your film.
Yeah.
But apparently Joe Berlinger played one of the people on the street giving an interview because they struggled so much that he was like, I'll just do it. Like, I'll just do it. Get me in front of the camera. It's a bit of a tragic story with the production, but do you want to hear some reviews?
Yes, please.
Reviews! This film has 14% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh my God.
A review published in The Guardian, everything, and I mean everything, that made The Blair Witch Project a little indie masterpiece has been falsified and trashed in this spectacularly bad sequel. Roger Ebert, who gave the first film 4 out of 4 stars, gave Book of Shadows 2 stars, calling it a muddled, sometimes atmospheric effort that could have come from many different filmmakers and not a very lucid piece of filmmaking. And he's right. It did kind of come from a lot of different filmmakers. People were just prodding at it. Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly awarded the film a C-minus rating, calling it a flat heebie-jeebies thriller. Here's a review left by John Lee T. 10 out of 10 review called A Powerhouse Performance by Kim Director. It's a great name. While this film is rather luckless, he actually said that. While this film is rather lackluster, no, my brain's melting. I'm sorry. Let me start again.
You got this. All right. Bip, take two.
While this film is rather lackluster and derivative, it is a standout performance by actress Kim Director that makes this a cinema must for anyone who appreciates truly great acting. Director is stunning in Blair Witch 2 and demonstrates how amazingly gifted in a role that is difficult to forget. Her work here will haunt you long after the motion picture has ended, incredibly memorable for the unique look and talent she brings to this otherwise forgettable piece. In several scenes, it is hard to catch one's breath as she acts purely with her fantastic eyes, expressing emotions few actors ever can. The pure horror she feels seems to come from the depths of her soul, so realistically powerful that it is nothing less than astounding. This motion picture has one element in it that overwhelms the viewer and which makes it essential viewing, the presence of one of the finest actors of our time in the person of Miss Kim Director. 10 out of 10. Literally, they're like, forgettable, but.
But fucking but. Kimmy D's in it.
Kimmy D. This is a 10 out of 10 review left by Tomster3 called Very Intelligent.
Oh.
Let me say first, my only disappointment was that the movie isn't longer. It built up such a great storyline, which really got me into it. Then it just stopped knowing that there was so much more it could have done. Obviously making way for the next in the series. Like Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back made way for Return of the Jedi.
Oh my God.
He's just talking about films coming in succession of in order. Even though it started slow, and at first I thought I wasn't going to like it during the opening scenes, showing flashes of gore, but like a Greek tragedy, the story takes you down a path to which there is no escape and continues to pile the tension until you almost can't take it. That's where it leaves you. Tense. It's like reading a good book and having to put it down only because your house is on fire, but you still try to keep reading it on the way out. 10 out of 10. 10 out of 10.
What an extended and mixed metaphor.
And here is a 10 out of 10 review left by Diana Presler 46164 called Superb Horror Film with Fine Cast. Director Joe Berlinger does an exemplary job of creating a truly terrifying environment in this film, and he keeps the suspense level high from beginning to very end shot. This is an intense film, and the thrills are unrelenting. Haunting imagery. Cast exceptional. It is, however, Kim Director,
oh my God,
who stands out and gives the film something very special. She is absolutely mesmerizing in the movie. And when she is on screen, no one can avert their eyes. She is a magnetic screen presence, and the camera loves her. Even when she isn't in a scene, her absence is sorely missed. And upon her return, the movie catches fire again. Oh my God. Her role here is essential, and casting her was a stroke of genius.
Oh my God.
10 out of 10. And here's just the last one. It's very quick.
Okay.
This was left by Goza 2. It's 10 out of 10, called Just Try and Forget This One. If I had to choose one word to describe Book of Shadows Blair Witch 2, it would be Kim Director. Oh. And as I left the theater with my cohorts, Pedro and James, each of us were visibly shaken and could not utter anything resembling a full sentence for at least half the ride home. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but I will say this. Book of Shadows is not a movie that is easily forgotten, nor is Kim Director. 10 out of 10.
Did she become a meme, or is this just a big titty by goth GF
thing?
It's
literally like, she's hot. I have to talk about how she's hot.
It's the same way that like trans women and fat women and stuff get fetishized. Like, it's just because she's goth, she's so goth. They're all like, it's like making the bone is so
fetish.
Hard.
It really is.
So fucking
they're
hard.
Like, my God, she's wearing like thick eyeliner and black leather. Like turned on. I've got a boner.
And so then they see her and they're like, fuck you. But then when they're jerking off, they're like, fucking Kimmy D. Kimmy D.
Well, Michelle, that was one horny young boy's review. What's your review?
One, it was three. my review? Listen, I'm torn between, this was goofy, I had a better time than many of these movies. It's also unbearably slow at times. Mm. I hate to say it, the studio interference kind of kills it. I think there's like an Urban Legends final cut, like release Joe Berlinger?
Yeah.
Release the Joe Berlinger cut.
Oh, yeah. You know? There is a Joe Berlinger cut. It was 2.5 hours long. You can't access
what?
It.
Oh, okay.
But he
two
did
and a half
have
hours
a cut.
Long,
it was it was a lot longer and very different. As
I
a
was
film.
Hoping it would be tighter, no. If anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, like, geez. The length sounds stupid, but you it was what? A very different kind of film.
I mean, for a debut feature, 2.5 hours for Book of
you're
Shadows.
Pushing it.
I think, okay, someone else recut. Don't release the Joe Berlinger cut. Someone else. Cut it.
Yeah.
To have Joe Berlinger's vision. Then I'll what? Then that is going to be 8 out of 10,
well, he
probably.
He should be allowed to recut it now with the experience that he's gained over the last
couple
of years.
I'm sure they gave him tons of movies after this,
he
right?
He actually did. He
really?
Kept working. Yeah, he's directed
awesome.
A bunch of shit.
Because so many of these movies, it's like, it's their second movie and then that's their last one.
Let
you
me
know?
Just check what he did, but I'm pretty sure he like went on to do a bunch of shit afterwards. Like,
makes
he's done.
Happy.
A bunch of movies. Yeah.
I can't remember his name, but the director of Urban Legends, that was like his first movie after editing a bunch, and he did not get another movie, and that made me sad because he made a good movie.
He is a documentary filmmaker and producer. He
that's
focuses
fun.
On true crime.
That's ironic, I think. Actually,
yeah, and social justice issues. He has done things such as Brother's Keeper, Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, Crude, Whitey, United States of America versus James J. Bulger, and Intent to Destroy, Death, Denial, and Depiction.
Cool.
Yeah. HuffPost article said that he's helped pioneer the style of documentary filmmaking seen in Netflix's True Crime Sensations, blah, blah, blah.
Oh,
he did
cool.
Making a Murderer, which is huge
oh,
on Netflix.
Whoa, he did. Wow.
He's done really well. He did, yeah.
Look at that guy go.
And he did Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes. Like, he's done heaps.
Wow. You know what? Joe Berlinger, if you're listening to this, and I know you are, good job. This movie, though, is probably like a 4.5 out of 10.
Oh.
Are you going to give it above a 5? This movie is... This list is destroying us.
Yeah, I should... I would watch this again before I would watch a good year.
I would watch this again.
Yeah.
We have to change what our average is because you have grown to hate a good year more.
I hated it when I saw it. I watched it with my mum and I remember saying, like, this is unbearably slow and boring.
I picked it as a perfectly neutral movie and you supported that. And then it's
turns
revealed that you hate
more.
It because you keep going, I would watch it before that.
There's actually, to be honest, there's a lot of films in this list I would watch before a good year.
Yeah.
And maybe
but again,
we should
but
change
we're also,
the metric.
Again, we're feral little gremlins who like watching bad movies.
Yeah.
You know what? Not next week, but soon we'll change what our barometer is,
sure.
What our 5-point is.
Email us at ratingdescending@gmail.com if you think you have a perfectly average film to recommend.
A perfect
5 out of 10
which,
film.
Which, remember, we picked a good year ostensibly because it does nothing wrong. Mm. It is, structurally, it is a tight screenplay.
It was
good stars doing good performances.
Nice.
It's well shot, well directed, but it leaves you with nothing.
Yes. An emptiness.
A perfect neutrality of movie. Nothing wrong, nothing done well.
Yeah. Well, I would give it like a 5.1 out of 10. Because right now, a good year is 5 out of 10.
Okay.
So I've just got to give it just a little bit over. All right?
Okay. I appreciate that it was, I assume, knocked down 2.1.
Oh, man. Well, if you enjoyed that, we do have social media, which you can find us on. And don't laugh at me. You can find us and follow us on. We're on Twitter at Rate Descend Pod. We're on TikTok under Rating Descending, or you can email us at ratingdescending@gmail.com about the perfect average film.
Yeah. Or if you've already done that and you're like, what else are these girls up to? You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Michelle.St. Clair.
And I'm on Instagram as well under Abigail J. Ward.
Also, pretty please, pretty please, pretty please, if you have the time, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It really makes a difference. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, Michelle, that was Blair Witch Project 2. What are we watching next week?
Next week, we are watching Speed 2 Cruise Control.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Speed 2, Jack goes to college. Annie goes to college.
Speed 2, the new batch. No, Speed 2, Book of Shadows, for
Book
sure.
Of Shadows. No, it would be Book of Shadows.
Speed 2.
Speed 2, yeah.
Colon Cruise Control. Yeah. We're keeping that.
Bye.
Bye.